But I'd be curious on the pasta front because, well, pasta, I wouldn't even know how to say it.
Oh,
sounds
really?
Like I said pasta. But how long were you on?
From about 2004 through to last year, so yeah.
That's crazy. How did you get into it? Like, what was the...
Just community service more than anything. I've been a Christian since 78, and I just have a purpose for our community. I mean, I've always been community-minded, and quite often people, it's not that they make bad decisions, they just lack the ability to talk things over with people. And I found myself doing that role anyway, so I felt it was just a step. We planted a church in Waitara, my wife and I, and we ended up with a building that was a previous church building belonging to the Brethren denomination. And during that whole process, we just had a place of worship and a place of belonging, and we had people coming to us. We're right in the middle of a residential area, so we had people coming to us from the residential area. I think it went well. I thought it went well for many years.
Well, I've been curious because I come across marketing from churches and how they pivoted and how they explain it. How did you get people start coming? What was your strategy?
It's just you provide a service. So people evaluate the service for themselves, whether that's something they want or don't want. And with that evaluation, they make the decision. So it's as simple as that. The other aspect is that I always had some difficulty with the idea of going to church in another town. So Waitara is a town very close to a city called New Plymouth. And we could have easily gone through to New Plymouth. I was an elder with Knox Presbyterian Church here in Waitara. And it got to the point where our church had got to a specific size that of numbers that we couldn't fit in the building. And I had six kids, my wife and I, and I was reasonably active in the youth ministry in Waitara. So I decided that it was time for us to move on, make space for others who perhaps wanted to go to Knox. And that's one of the reasons why we left Knox as an elder and we planted another church. We didn't take anyone from the existing church. We just decided that that what we'll do is provide a service and allow for others to join us.
Did you door knock? Did you explain it? Did you go to supermarkets? Like how
no, no, nothing
you
like
open
that.
It, you get nervous?
No, nothing like that. I mean, I think we had a website, Facebook page. people knew me. It was just as simple as that.
Easy. Wow. What's it like day to day? What are your? Is there like a rule book you guys follow? Like, do you get trained?
So we're independent. We weren't part of a denomination. I struggled with the whole denomination process, largely because denominations are built on rules made by man or humanity, and rules that are usually put in place to impose restrictions on other people. So I had a concept of people wanting to belong, to believe and then behave. Most denominations have the concept of people behaving first before we let you belong. Behaving first before you believe, and then you can belong. And the problem with that is, do people ever feel like they belong because they don't adhere to the rules or something about it, the place they don't like, so that they feel like they don't belong? Whereas if you create the opportunity for people to belong from the time they walk into the door, and that they're a respected member of the community and a respected member of your group, your organization, then effectively they feel like they belong, and they don't necessarily have to believe what we believe, and they don't necessarily have to behave like the way we all behave. So it's everyone's got their own responsibilities, and eventually in time, I found people wanted to believe what you believe, because they wanted to experience it for themselves. They could see that it was more than just a set of rules. It was actually a lifestyle, a personal belief, and a faith that obviously had rewards for us, and other people wanted to experience similar rewards for themselves. So the behaving and the believing always came after the belonging.
Interesting. Is there like a corporate version? Like, are they franchises denominations? Are they part of a larger group? Like, I know they're not franchises, but
yeah.
How do you be part of a denomination? Do you go apply for a school in Melbourne, or
No, so it'd be pretty hard to set up a church under a denomination unless you already were and you came from that particular denomination, and that denomination gave you authority to branch out and plant a church in a particular area. It just doesn't happen that way. So I mean, you got to think about what were the reasons for churches in the first place. Churches weren't institutions; they weren't set up as organizations. Churches were, in the early days, in the early century, where people met in family homes, and they looked after each other. They shared a meal together. They taught about their values that were that they learnt from the early disciples, and they passed those on to each other. Eventually, over time, humanity steps in, and they want to come up with rules and set up organizations. Then the organizations own the assets, and then you have to behave the way they tell you to behave. You have to follow certain areas of qualifications to belong, and that isolates and alienates people because we all have values. You have values for yourself, Ryan. I'm not saying your values are wrong or right or anything, but I respect the fact that you have choices. And God, in the Old Testament said we all have choices. Choose blessings, choose curse. Choose life, choose death. Whatever you choose, just make a choice. Don't try and sit in between and have feet in both camps. So we were in the same process. We had a set of values that Ruth and I operated on, that we believed. Our values weren't what we imposed on the community. Our values were our lifestyle. With that, we allowed opportunity for other people to belong, to join in with that, to add their values to what were our values. And then in time, people believed at what we believed, you know. So it wasn't as such. It was very organic, you could say. It wasn't puppeting, setting up people on strings and things like that. It just wasn't my thing. I mean, the same with families, you know. Do we make rules on how people can belong to families? It doesn't work that way, do you know?
Yeah, well, you're speaking from as though you've experienced or witnessed things that you weren't happy that was created by man. Is there, does it attract a certain type of person to run a church as part of an institution? Because, you know, I see the extremities of wealth where they've done well and tax
Yeah.
efficiencies of it.
So
And then
certainly, if you
also,
belong to an institution, you have security. So I was never part of church for the purposes of making an income or have money out of it. It just wasn't that wasn't the case. In fact, I've never received an income from a church in my life. You know, to me, church is always family. You don't get income from family because you belong to a family. It's the same process. But for some people who choose that as their career, they find security that a denomination will pay them a salary. It's never a lot of, you're never going to get wealthy by being a minister of the church, but you do have security. In effect, in most denominations, if you're the minister, you're the leader of that church. So you don't have anyone above you telling you what to do. You have a group of rules that you have to adhere to, a set of values and lifestyle that you have to live by. And you do have a higher court in the church that will provide discipline if they feel that you're not doing things right. But in today's Western society, we have people in churches who are doing what's right in their own eyes, and they go off and do that because they think it's good for the community. And I struggle with that because it's not about what's right in your eyes. We have a moral code here in New Zealand that we've inherited through our Christian heritage. That moral code was given to us by an absolute good person who had an absolute purpose and who he is, and that be Jesus Christ. Because we can say that the moral code that we have was not designed by man, the moral code we have was handed down to us over generations and proved to be good. So it's not about doing what's good in our own eyes. It's been by doing what's good according to the absolute truth.
do you think the values of God are still in society as we speak now?
Our values are changing, and I don't, and I know the values aren't good. In a lot of ways, we are degrading our values based on what we think is good today. And Ryan, I could say to you, you tell me what you think is good, And I could ask another person. I can even put in my values as to what I think are good. And there'll be three different what is good. So if you're doing what's good in your eyes and it's offending a guy next door to you who does something totally different, what's good in his eyes, then is there a truth that says what is good for all people? There isn't. And so that's why we have so many extremism in New Zealand today, extremists on the left and the right, perpetrating what they think is good and imposing their values over other people and degrading them because their values are different. The truth of the matter is we all have different values. Let's accept that. Let's accept each other's values, but acknowledge the fact there is one good moral code, and that good moral code was given to us by an absolute God.
Interesting. I think nature has laws in a way. Like, I've never seen someone that caused cruelty to others and lied and was dishonest, never had consequences for that, whether to themselves and the relationships they have or with themselves. There seems to be an order in the chaos. But I'd be curious, regardless of if someone believes in God or not, the Bible is one of the most popular books ever written. What do you think about it resonates so powerfully with people, except for the God aspect? What do you think about the story speaks to humans?
Okay, so this is my take on it, Ryan. Basically, the words written in the scriptures were written by a group of people over the years, men and women. They weren't all Jewish and they weren't all Christian. That they were different groups of people throughout the generations who wrote words that inspired them from their own relationship with God. And we as a church accept those words as being Holy Spirit inspired, and they form our scriptures. Those scriptures have been tested for generations as to whether they are correct and true. Even in our Western thinking for the last 300 years, we've tested those scriptures as to whether they've been made up, whether they have been, whether they've come from what seems to be good sounding information, but we've tested them, and theologians over the centuries have discovered that basically that the word has not changed at least since 600 BC. So the words in the scriptures are the same that were in 600 BC all the way through to this date, and that have been tried and tested. We can't say that about a lot of other faiths, because that they were written centuries after the person who might have said something. In this case, we have sound documentation and proof that says that a lot of the words that we have, even in the New Testament, were written within 20 or 30 years of the events that happened. And this would be like today, denying that John F. Kennedy was even alive, or denying that he died in the 60s. Nobody today would say that. We all acknowledge that John F. Kennedy was assassinated, that he did exist. And so we're able to rely on testimony that was written within 20 years of 1960, if that was to be the example. And if we were to put that same evidence in front of a courtroom with the witnesses that would turn up and say they saw, they heard, they hear, they saw what happened, there wouldn't be a jury that would say it didn't happen. They would have had to acknowledge that what was said by Jesus Christ, what he did, what the apostles did, what the disciples did, that was truth. And the reason why it resonates today in the minds of people that read it is that they're reading the inspired word of God, though it's inspired by to men and interpreted by men and written down, that it's been tried over the years. And as you were too, Ryan, there's been countless other books over the time that we call the Apocrypha. They're not entirely accepted as the inspired word of God. So they're not always included into the canon, into the book of the Bible, books of the Bible. Although they are, you can read them, you can find them for yourself. And there are some interesting aspirations that you can get from the book, from the Apocrypha, from the various books. And of course there's movies written about some of the Apocrypha, but that's sort of good entertainment, really. The reality of it is that the Bible does provide inspirational words for people that they can apply to their lives and use that for their moral code as to how they conduct themselves, how they see life, and how they can get on with themselves.
I'm fascinated with the story aspect. Are there, like, when you'd ever do your talks, I imagine you did talks sometimes for your belonging church.
Yeah.
Planted's an interesting idea instead of built. So were there stories that were crowd favorites that resonated? Because that's what I'm interested in, like emotional stories that resonate. And because that's what the story is, an incredible book of incredible stories that hit someone in a different way.
Yeah. So Bible teachers who speak in churches, I guess there's two schools of thought on that. So some teach from a group of lessons, and they might read from the scriptures and teach verse by verse. They might teach what has come out of those verses to themselves and to the people listening. That's one way. Another way is to be inspired by various things that you're learning yourself through scriptures. Because, I might be 64 years old, Brian, but I'm still learning things every day. And I feel like I have to learn them quicker because I don't have the number of years in front of me to learn these things like I had years gone past. So sometimes through this learning, when I read the scriptures, I find something that I might have read several times over my life, but for some unknown reason today, it's revelational and there's something inspirational in it. And so I will teach from that. It's not necessarily new stuff. I can remember, and I guess I should be embarrassed to say this, but I can remember I was a Christian for many years, and this would be early 2000s. I read a book on Martin Luther and how he climbed the steps in his local cathedral on his knees as part of a process of buying penance from the church and repentance from the church. And he climbed up on his knees up many steps, and there'd be a lot of other people behind him doing the same thing. And the idea was that they would buy penance, and the penance money went into the coffers of the church, and the church would do things like build armies, build buildings and whatever else. But the idea was they invoked on people the mindset that they had to do things to find a payment for their sins, you could say, okay? And so that's what penance is. And there's Martin Luther climbing the stairs, and one time he climbed the stairs and he hurt his knees, and he got to the top of the stairs, and then he turned around, put the money into the coffer at the top, turned around and looked behind him, and all these other people were coming up, and he felt no more clean from his issues that he was struggling with than what he did before he started that day. And he was totally totally demoralized about the whole process of how you're capturing people into doing this particular role and not even being able to suffice their needs. And he went away, and I don't know how long it was before he read a scripture called "The Just Shall Live by Faith." Okay? And so to be justified, to be cleaned or sanctified, as we would say in the church, to be clean of your sins, wasn't about a process of works. It was a process of living by faith. And not by having to change. It's like this. Do you get yourself clean to get into the shower, or do you get into the shower to get yourself clean? And the church, the institutional church, creates an environment where you have to clean yourself before you go to church. The reality of it is you get cleansed by being in church, by worshiping, by in prayer, and you get cleansed by your own revelation of reading the scriptures for yourself. Okay, and so there he learnt, and then it wasn't to the early 2000s that I discovered that actually we're saved by grace, not by works. And for most of my life up to that particular point, I had been working to make myself morally good, as a Christian, working to try and do good things for people in the hope that I was becoming a good person. But the reality of it is it was nothing. It meant nothing to anyone, except perhaps myself, and meant nothing to God. It was considered, according to the scriptures, as dirty as rags. And these were cleaning rags, body cleaning rags, as the old Hebrew word would say. And so the reality of it is, if there's nothing I can do to make myself better, then what can I do? And I discovered for myself, reading the book of Martin Luther, that the just shall live by faith. I discovered that for myself, the just shall live by faith. And it's about a belief in who God is, discovering him for yourself, and being able to have a personal relationship with God, and knowing him and what his words are, and then living by that, and not necessarily by something that I would think is good.
That's interesting, because obviously I'm looking at it from the atheist viewpoint. Like, I see guilt as like a currency people pay to forgive themselves, but you can never pay enough.
You can never pay. You can never. That's it. You're exactly right, Ryan. There's nothing you can do to pay for the guilt that you've inherited. You know, and you either inherited through your family lifestyle, inherited through your previous generations, or you've inherited through your own decisions that you made for yourself. And you can't justify yourself through that guilt. There's nothing you can pay to get to deal with that guilt. In fact, when Christ died on the cross, he said, "It is now finished." Just before he died, he says, "It is finished," which means there's nothing I can do that can add to the price of what was paid for on the cross. I can't add to it. And if I make any attempt to add it, then I'm saying to Jesus that I am equal or better than you, because I am now adding to what you did on the cross to make myself better. There's nothing I can do. Okay. And I take my hand off to people who can honestly say to me they're atheists. Absolutely. Because what they're telling me is they feel they're like God, and that they know everything. And the reality of it is, there's only one entity I know that knows everything, and that's God. And there's only one entity I know that's everywhere, and that's God. And there's only one entity I know that's all-powerful, and that's God. So when someone tells me, and I no criticism of my own, but when someone tells me they're an atheist, they tell me they have been everywhere in the universe. They have discovered in every crook and cranny under every rock that they've seen, there is no God and there is no Jesus. Okay? And so I take my hat off that somebody can live with that much faith, because I struggle. I don't have that much faith. Okay. So when someone tells me they're an atheist, I look and say to them, I marvel at the level of faith that they have, that they can say that there is no God.
Well, I marvel in your faith as well, my friend. That's it.
Fine sounding argument, say.
Yeah, I mean, there's no hill I'll die on, put it that way.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good way to approach life, is try to understand why you're wrong. You know, I think life with God is beautiful, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So moving away from that, you did well. A lot of people would get daunted at the idea of it, but you didn't. Well, you're also an avid shooter. So you've got you're a religious pastor that shoots guns. So when was the first time you had a relationship with guns, my friend?
What's the ideology? A gun-tooting Christian? Is it something like this?
We'll get to the political side of things too, but like, what's when was the first time you're like, oh yeah, guns are pretty cool? How old were you?
I was 17. I left boarding school. I liked the outdoors. I liked being alone in a lot of ways. I spent a lot of time on walks and tramps through the Euro eras, and I used to come across the occasional deer killer back in those days, and they were interesting guys to talk to. They were pretty gruff. They were just different people. Some ways antisocial. And I sort of was quite inspired by some of their own talks. Guys like Barry Crump, who had some interesting words that they wrote on their own, you know, and things like that. So I liked the idea of hunting. And then I went and I got my license about 1978. I bought my first gun, 22, went out shooting rabbits and possums. And I just moved on from there.
Do you feel closer to God in a way, which it sounds probably closer to nature, or closer to your primal state as a man being out there in nature, and then you, in a way, have to live off what you get, you know, like you have to find a way to, like, do you reach a different type of state when you're hunting?
You do. I wouldn't say that's a primary goal or an objective of mine. I guess I like the idea of providing good flavored meat for the table for my family. I like the idea of being able to do something where you're the one that's responsible for all your actions. You're responsible for the environment you're in. You're responsible for making sure it's left tidy behind. When I'm camping, make sure you clean up after you. I like the idea that the only thing you leave behind are your footprints, not necessarily rubbish. And I do like the fact that I guess we kill our own meat, whether it be birds of the air or fur on the ground. And that from that perspective, it's clean, it's green. Uh, it, hopefully hasn't eaten any 1080, and it's all good. You know, I know when I'm out with other guys, and I think that's the other side of it more so, Ryan, is that when I'm out with other men, we can sit around and we're probably sitting around a fire, or we're just cooking up our meal and we share it amongst each other, and we have a chat and we talk about things, yeah. And I find men will talk about things out in the bush that they would never talk about around a sofa in the kitchen, in the lounge or kitchen table. You know, there's something, there's a little bit different about being out there under the open sky. I can give you a heap of examples where you're lying there and it rains and you get wet and you're soaked, or it snows and you get frozen and you can't wait for the sun to come up so you can dry everything out and get warmed up again. You know, is it pleasant? I can give you plenty of examples where I've never found myself been in a pleasant position when I'm out hunting, but somehow when you get home, it was worth it. You know, and just to experience life different, that there is something out there. I mean, how many times, Ryan, that I've taken young guys from this town of Waitara with me out hunting, and without even adding any words to it, the comments I get back from nearly all the young guys after their first time out hunting or out in the bush is, I wish I knew that this was available to me when I was younger. Do you know? And they wouldn't have got themselves into trouble. They would have realized that there is more to life than being caught in suburbia, stuck around a house. Because a lot of people today are brought up in single parent families. Mothers have got a great job looking after what they have. But for young men, they need to have that little bit of getting out there and enjoying life different from being inside the kitchen with mum, you know. And in some ways, a little bit of danger doesn't go far wrong for a young lad, because it teaches him responsibilities, teaches him how to look after people around him as well. You know, if you tie guys up too much to a house, and eventually when they get the right and their own right to leave the house, they go out and they become like a loose cannon, and they just go out and do destructive stuff to both themselves and to their neighbours around them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know the exact percentage, but it's extremely high of prisoners. Something like 85% of prisoners come from fatherless homes.
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, the number of times I've had guys out with me, and I'm teaching them things for the first time, and what I enjoy about it is not that I've taught them something, but I get to watch. It's a real honourable position. I get to watch them experience something for the first time and seeing their face change. You know, every young guy I have, I take them up to the range. I show them how to shoot. I show them how to handle a gun, and I give them a number of lessons to the point where they feel like it's almost muscle memory, and they get a little bit bored with what I'm teaching them. But I rather they learn that and learn muscle memory. And then when I take them out hunting, and just before we go into an area where there's something to hunt, I say to them, look, now, from this point onwards, you will forget just about everything I taught you. And they'll go, oh, no, I remember. No, you'll forget it. What I want to tell you is that I won't have the time to solve it for you. If you've got a problem, you're going to have to solve it yourself. I've taught you everything you need to solve your issues, but I'll be with them, you see. Every time that the hunt comes up, the animal's there, they go to shoot it, and there might be multiple animals, like in the case of herd of goats, and there'll be a few minutes of a bit of gunfire to deal with what's in front of us. When it finishes and the smoke's cleared and everything's gone settled again, the guys turn around, I can see it on their face, they said, you're right, I forgot everything you said during that whole process of what was happening. I think there's a terminology for it, but it's not in my head at the moment. But it's just that experience of being out with guys when they experience all these things for the first time. You know, I've been out with guys who don't know what it's like to clean up an animal after you've shot it so you can bone it and take the meat home. And they find that an awkward situation, you know, getting covered in blood and the smell that comes with that, and working through that with them. And that's an experience. Another one's carrying the animals out and you feel the blood flow down your neck and down your back. And everything gets sticky and tacky and you feel real grubby, but that's the process.
It's the realities of life.
Yeah.
I think there's an inherent desire for humans to crave pleasure, convenience, and, you know, because we have a big brain that requires a lot of energy. So we want to find the thing that makes us fat and convenient. But the thing that brings us fulfillment, in a way, is the alleviation of suffering, is experiencing some sort of suffering for a common goal, and then achieving that goal despite the hurdles that you experience in life. And that's, I think that's what a lot of people are missing in life, is the struggle, the willing struggle.
No, I don't think anyone wants to be a clone, and yet Western civilization is trying to train people to be clones so that we all look like each other and we all do the same thing, and what one person finds acceptable, everyone does the same thing. The fact is, we are all different. Some people like hunting, some people don't. I know that, you know. My experience of taking a bunch of youth out hunting possums was what got me. I just couldn't believe it. I was in my 30s, and I just thought everyone liked hunting. And I discovered that that wasn't the case. And I had a great big 5-ton truck, and we went down the country road cleaning up possums on the road. And we had a group of teenage girls in the back and a group of teenage boys, and they behaved completely different from each other. The boys jumped off the truck and they killed the possums with their bare hands, you know, or feet or gumboots. And the girls were in the back screaming. And I thought, well, they're enjoying it too, because they're screaming, you know. And it wasn't until we stopped after an hour doing this and we had the truck full of possums on the back of the truck that I get back to where we were. And I ended up being told off by these girls in no uncertain terms that I was cruel, I was mean, I was disgusting. I thought, but didn't you enjoy that? And I couldn't believe it. They didn't enjoy it. And the next day I was talking to the farmer, because we were camping out there, and the farmer said, I saw you went out and killed a few possums last night. Yeah, took the youth group out. And he said to me, so how'd the girls go? I says, how do you know about that? Man, I couldn't get over that. The girls just didn't like the hunting. How can you not like it? So, it's an interesting experience to discover that some people do things well and other people do things differently. And we can't be cloned to each other. You know, we can't be the same as each other. What we have to do is learn to respect each other, so that there are things that you like doing, Ryan, that would bore the living daylights out of me.
Oh, yeah.
And it might even disgust me, you know. but it still makes you to be the good citizen that you are today. And same likewise, I expect the same thing from other people looking at me, that they respect who I am, as long as I'm doing what is considered morally right and good, and I'm enjoying life and building society. Why should it be wrong?
Yeah, it actually leads to a very dangerous thing politically when everyone turns into groupthink. So there was a psychologist, Carl Jung, and he predicted World War II after the Treaty of Versailles, because a lot of people had lost their individuality and they were conforming to a group. And what happens is, when you lose your individuality and you conform to a group, you start building this inner turmoil. And you're looking for someone to blame for it, because they feel differently, but they're conforming. And then someone comes along like Hitler, and he starts saying, this is the cause of your pain, this is the celebration, and it is a very strong individual. So it is, I think, why do you think society, do you notice a change from when you first grew up to now? Because it seems...
Yeah, big changes. We concentrate on the word unity. As society, we have to be in unity with each other, instead of acknowledging that people are different. When I grew up, everyone was different. You know, I whether it was just me or what, but I acknowledged that a lot of people were different. Today, we have to be in unity with each other, and unity is good. You know, and unity is what builds civilizations and society. We all have to be on the same track. We all have to agree with each other. And I think when we get to that particular point, we are on the verge of national, if not international, disaster, because there will be other people that will think differently from that, and they will become disunity, you know, and they will move off on their own. And we can see that with Germany. They were picked on through the Treaty of Versailles, and rightly or wrongly. I mean, one part of me, I guess if I was there writing the treaty, I'd probably agree with what the Allies did, on the grounds that Germany owed so much to Europe for what happened with the World War One. But then, did they cause World War One? Indications are they didn't cause it. They just lost, and so the victor was able to impose regulations on the people that they couldn't say no to. And it wasn't too some years later, after depression and many other things that happened, that the will of the people became strong against the allies, that they decided to go off and do their own thing and become what they were. The problem with unity is exactly that, that we will find that there'll be groups of people that will disagree with what people are saying they should unify behind. And if the unity becomes too strong on one side, then they'll create extremism on the other side. And I guess we're seeing that in a lot of ways. We're seeing that classic example, whether it's my opinion or not, we seem as a Western society to have to back, let's say, the pride movement. Today, if you don't want to be seen in politics and not be supporting the pride movement, because if you weren't supporting the pride movement, you've been disunited. You know, you've been extremists. And yet, if one was to ask honestly everyone in society that question about whether they support pride movement, their argument would be, well, they can do what they want to do. That's their choice. But don't expect me to teach my kids to be that, you know, or something to that effect. If we were to be honest, I think you find most of society would say, why do we have to paint pedestrian crossings in rainbow colors? We don't do it for anyone else in society. Why do we have to do it for them? You know, and look, I'm not saying anything negative. I think people have their choice, their lifestyle, choose where they want to go. The unfortunate thing is we don't always have to agree with it. And to be in disagreement doesn't necessarily mean that you're being disunity, you know. You're just believing in your values and what you think is important to yourself, but we don't oppose them on anyone.
So is it the movement itself? Like, I know usually this viewpoint stems from, let's say, transsexual or drag queen people teaching kids certain values, and then also, you know, puberty blockers and all that stuff and having consequence for kids, and that's where people get really passionate. Is it that side of the movement, or what about the movement is like, would you treat, if you met someone that was gay, would you treat them with courtesy and respect?
Absolutely. Some of my best friends are gay.
Ah, yes.
You know, and I'll have them around my house for dinner. That doesn't worry me. It's their choice. It's their choice. They can choose that. If that's where they feel satisfied in their life to do that, they can do that. It doesn't matter. No one's going to tell me too who I'm going to marry. And I'm doing the same thing. I'm not telling them who they can not have a relationship with. That's their business. I do, as an older person in society now who has a sort of a feeling of a responsibility for society, I do have some difficulty when we start teaching kids at pre the age of majority, age of 18, that they can do what they like. And they can accept different lifestyles. That means also they can change their gender and things like that. I have difficulty with that because my experience is no one under the age of 25 has the right mind to consider that type of thing. It's not till we get post 25, and psychiatrists will tell you that, it's not till we get post 25 that our mind starts to mature to a perspective where we can have full understanding of some of the repercussions of some of the decisions that we make. Do you know? I've seen TikTok videos of young women who have changed their gender. And I've got a good friend of mine, and I won't say we or anything, but a good friend of mine who changed her gender, moved in with a girl, lived in an alternative lifestyle. That's their choice. But now, 10 years down the track, she tells me, with a beard and a change of body, that she wished she didn't do it and wants to go back the other way, and she can't. Do you know? I just don't think that we do the right by people by teaching them at a young age that they have these choices. The reality is, in my opinion, there's male and female, and that's it. You know, when a doctor pulls a baby out and says to the baby it's a boy, that's exactly what they're saying. It's a boy or a girl, do you know? In the 60s and 70s when I grew up, if people thought differently, then the issue wasn't with their body parts. The issue was what was happening in their head.
Yeah, I think that's they're quite strong issues. I sort of think the approach at the moment lacks compassion. So it's like this person feels as though they don't belong, whether it's in their body or in their society or in their family. And they're trying to find a solution to that. And it's one of those one-way decisions where once you decided You've decided. Now, imagine for a moment if you got supported and loved and cared for, and you still felt like you didn't belong as an adult, but at least all resources were exhausted, and that person actually had the support and care that they needed, and maybe they have some stability. Because even if they change and think that's going to alleviate their suffering, they're still going to have to exist in a world for the most part doesn't accept it. You know, it doesn't allow them in certain bathrooms, doesn't allow them to compete in certain sports, doesn't allow them to put certain things on passports. It's a bit more accommodating. So then they're also going to need to develop the emotional fortitude as well as the skills to navigate a world that doesn't accept their new identity. So I don't see the benefit to them and be like, hey, let's make a decision now. But anyways.
Right. I think you hit the nail on the head. It goes right, it stems right back to the first point that you said was they don't feel they like they belong. And that's the issue with society in a lot of ways. Do any of us feel like we belong here? As the level of confidence between those who seem to be more successful and those who seem less successful is dependent on the level of belonging that they feel they belong to. And so even after people make these decisions and do what they do, they still don't feel like they belong. And here's a classic example where we can say to people in society, look, you can have a relationship with whoever you like. Just choose. Yeah, it's your choice. Do that. And then the whole process is that they continually, those who are on the LGBTQ spectrum of society feel like they're always having to justify their decision for what they've done. And that's why we have gay prides, to prove that we're accepted, to continue down that track. And they're always searching for that acceptance. Now, it might be a generalized statement, but it seems like on council, we have to make decisions to allocate for people who make those decisions. We don't seem to have to make a decision to allocate for those who make other decisions, you know? And I just think it's about belonging. We need to tell everyone you belong. You belong to our society. You belong to our city. You belong to our district, our town, wherever, you know, and respect people for who they are. If they make a decision that doesn't affect you but affects themselves and enter into a relationship that they want to enter into, why stop them? The only person that has authority over that is mum and dad when they're under the age of 18. And again, does a parent actually have the right to deny someone a choice even under the age of 18? And if they try and impose that, then they impose rebellion in the life of that teenager. So you're best wanting to live and work with your children. So allowing them to see the repercussions of all the decisions they make. Not just the major ones, but also the minor ones. I mean, I brought up six kids, right? And I got to tell you, I can remember when I was in my 20s, I can remember some of my workmates saying to me, yeah, come on, Jonathan, what would you do? Because they knew I was a Christian, they knew I went to church. What would you do if your son comes home one day and says he's gay? And my discussion to that was, it's not going to happen. My children won't make that decision. They said, how can you say that? I said to them, well, because that decision is an event of a number of other decisions that lent to that particular perspective. Okay. I know guys who, if you were to talk to them, you think they were gay, right? But they're not, you know? So just because they talk differently, act differently, doesn't necessarily mean they're gay, you know? I'm not saying that decisions we make are a product of our being, but certainly they can be. You know, and the more adverse the decision that we make is usually more based on the adversity we had growing up in life.
So when you say they come to you and say they're gay, they won't make that decision because they're not able to make that decision until they're 19, or what makes you?
No. It's a lifestyle that we teach our kids. Again, we don't impose it. We let them live with our values, and they get to see the real Jonathan and the real Mrs. Marshall, you know. They don't see us sitting in our chairs imposing a set of rules that we can't believe or belong to or behave to ourselves, you know. We show them the reality of what decisions are. I mean, again, I'll refer back to the scriptures. In Deuteronomy, it says, choose life, choose death, choose blessings, choose curse. The verses that follow talk about the repercussions of what you might choose around those decisions. You know? And so we teach our kids that, yes, we make bad decisions. I don't make good decisions all the time, Ryan. I make bad decisions as I go. But my repercussions, the consequences of my decision making, is what I will choose to accept, because they're my consequences. And so I show my grandkids what happens when you make a bad decision. You know, and I don't hide it. I own it. I made a bad decision of that. These are the consequences. I have to live with it. I brought dishonor to myself, or whatever the point might be. You know, if you drive down the road and you get caught speeding, you get a speeding ticket. Is it someone else's fault? No, it's my fault. And you learn that from the smallest decisions, not from the big ones.
What would you do if they're like 30, they're like, hey, Dad, I'm gay. What happens?
It won't happen.
It just won't happen. Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah. It just won't happen. I mean, it's... I mean, all my kids, and I wish you could talk to them, but all my kids are honourable kids. You know, and we had we grew up in a town called Waitara. My kids grew up, they went to Waitara High. They didn't go to any special schools. They lived with society, and I didn't isolate them. I didn't isolate myself. I don't isolate myself. And so they get to see both sides of the fence.
Well, how about a different tip? If there's a young person listening to this and they're in a family where they're pretty sure they're gay, and they're worried that they won't be accepted in that family if they share that, what would your advice to be for a father for another family, for that person that's concerned about?
My heart would just go out to them. I mean, that's a sense of empathy that we all have when that happens in a family like that. You know, I don't know what causes people to lean differently in regards to that. Some people say it's we're born with our gender, whatever's. I don't know. I've had people talk with me over similar things like that from the perspective of the young person, not from the parents. The parents, my experience have in some cases hidden that from me, but the child would talk to me about it. And again, my heart just goes out, you know. I just talk about the consequences. I talk about the decisions they make, you know. I talk about what it means to be in society. And being gay today is not an issue. If people want to be gay, they can be gay. I don't think that's an issue. The issue is what they're doing to themselves. If the reason for being gay is because they want to go on the attack to mum and dad, then that's an issue, because they won't solve that. If they're being gay because it's a natural desire, then that's their choice. You know, it's what caused the fruit to be what it is. You know, if fruit was caused by disobedience, destruction, or to prove a disappointment, then those are the wrong reasons for having made that decision.
I didn't expect
every decision you make should be a benefit to yourself, and from a perspective of believing that you're doing right by yourself and by your neighborhood.
I didn't expect to talk about these things. Usually people are scared of them. I don't go.
No, that's fuck. Okay. Yeah, and I'm trying to be as honest as I can with you, Ryan. I'm not trying to hide anything. You can ask any question, and I'll be as honest as I can. You might lose viewers, or you might get a whole lot more.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I'm quite liberal and atheist, so maybe I need some more of your side.
Again, these are my perspectives, and it's am I right? I don't know if I'm right. I mean, I never know whether I'm right, but it's worked for me and it's worked for my family.
Yeah, it's mean, and we won't get into this issue, but it, like, even like the whole pro-choice and, you know, pro-life thing, my approach is like pro-parenting, like pro-parent, like giving people the confidence and support to feel as though they could raise a family, encouraging men to take responsibility. But I just think that empathy, whatever your viewpoint, is probably going to aid you in life. And I don't think empathy is being nice, I think, or people-pleasing. Sometimes empathy is being kind, like allowing those men to shoot and fail. like you did. Is there other lessons that you have learned as a man, either in a relationship or in his career, that you have has aided you?
In my career and in my life, I try to imagine what it would be to be in their shoes. Of course, there's the old moccasin story, to try and walk in their moccasins for a period of time. You know, I try to imagine in my mind's eye with them what it would be in their lifestyle. I mean, when we had our children when they were babies, and we had friends who lost theirs, you know, I tried to imagine what it would be like to lose one of mine, and then feeling the emotion, the hurt that goes with that. You certainly develop an understanding of other people. You always know that you can't help somebody through a situation like that, but you can stand beside somebody in a situation like that, you know. And I think that's the difference, to be there when they decide you need them to be there, not when you can afford the time to be there. You know, and that's the case with every situation. And that's what, I guess, why in society we need to have that sense of belonging. So we don't want to belong so that we can be told what to do or to be where we are. We want to belong so that when we need help, we can reach out and then we know there's going to be somebody there. You know, because society, and we learned this through COVID, society cannot survive as individuals. If we lived in our house and we didn't go out, we didn't meet people, even with Zoom, it never solved the issue. We still had mental breakdown, a growth in mental health issues over COVID because people weren't able to be social beings and going out and socializing with other people. So we as society are dependent on the need, or we as humanity are dependent on the need that we have to belong to a group of people or feel like we belong to a group of people and to be socially aware of each other's needs.
Well said. Well, you've done a podcast, so thanks for coming on.